Blog Talk Radio.
Unfortunately, last minute changes. Mr. C. Sunny Martin had an unexpected emergency about 20 minutes ago, so I have to switch the show around a little bit. We'll probably get back to maybe tomorrow night with Mr. Sonny Martin. So tonight, I'm just going to finish off the 98 symptoms to those that have recovered from COVID-19. These are some of the complaints that they have said that they've experienced throughout the COVID-19. I will get back to you about Mr. Sonny Martin, though. Unfortunately, though, he did have an emergency, so we got to switch around a little bit. No problem. Auntie's got all kinds of treasures up her sleeve, so we'll get through the night. Yesterday, we left off, I believe it was 85, yes, because we were talking about COVID toe. And so now tonight is 84. One of the symptoms of COVID-19 long-lasting effects are eye sty or infection. According to the University of Miami, it's possible that coronavirus could cause an eye infection, such as conjunctivitis, also known as pink eye. The American Academy of Ophthalmology concludes that styes are caused by bacterial infections, which could explain the relationship to this eye condition in the virus. Number 83 is foot pain, and it's not those high, cute heels that we wear, women. This is another kind of foot pain. Foot pain can be caused by a number of ailments, such as corns, bladder fascites, Achilles tendon injuries, COVID toe. Many contribute to this pain, since some patients can have trouble walking or sleeping due to lesions on the toes. In most cases, this strange symptom goes away, so the foot pain should also subside. Number 82 would be gout or lump in the throat. A gouter is an abnormal enlargement of the lymphoid gland. According to the American Thyroid Association, while a goiter doesn't necessarily mean the thyroid isn't functioning correctly, it does indicate that there's a potential hormone imbalance causing the thyroid gland to grow abnormally. 70 survey respondents dealt with gouter after COVID-19, possibly due to hormones effects of the virus has on the body. 81 is cracked or dry lips, not just winter lips. Cracked or dry lips can occur in especially cold or hot weather. It may be a sign of dehydration. While when a virus like COVID-19 takes hold, dry lips may also occur because viruses are likely the cause of dehydration. The American Academy of Dermatology suggests using lip balm, drinking plenty of fluids, and refraining from picking the dry skin on your lips. As your auntie would say, leave it alone. Let it heal. Number 80 would be cold or burning feeling in the lungs. 74 people surveyed reporting this symptom. COVID-19 is a respiratory virus, so it's no wonder that those who contracted the illness feel a cold or burning sensation in their lungs. However, this symptom may last longer than the virus, since 74 participants reported this feeling after coronavirus was gone. An article published in NBC News concludes that many COVID-19 sufferers felt this slow burn for a while until it either worsened or was treated or went away completely. Number 79 is low blood oxygen. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, bluish lips or face is an emergency of COVID-19. When your lips turn blue, it's a sign your blood oxygen has dipped to extreme levels. The survey found that 77 participants claimed that experienced low blood oxygen after contracting coronavirus. Listen, if you're turning blue, don't even think about anything else. Just get your behind to the emergency room and get you some air, please. Okay, don't be a hero trying to give mouth to mouth. Go get you some oxygen. Okay, number 78 is arrhythmia. The Mayo Clinic defines arrhythmia as a heart rhythm problem and explains it happens when electrical impulses that coordinate the heartbeat doesn't work properly, causing your heart to beat too fast, too slow, or irregularly. A study published in Heart Rhythm studied hospitalized coronavirus patients and found some of them suffered bradyrhythmias, or cardiac arrest. The study concluded heart traumas and abnormalities like these are likely the consequence of systematic illness and not solely the direct effect of COVID-19 infection. Oh, wow, that's serious. The number 77 is jaw pain. In the survey, 80 participants reported jaw pain as a long-lasting symptom of COVID-19. According to the American Dental Association, jaw pain may be caused by bone problems, stress, infection, sinus issues, or teeth grinding. It's known that coronavirus causes aches and pains, so this jaw pain may be lingering side effects of the body fighting off the virus. Number 76, painful scalp and burning sensation. COVID-19 sufferers, a painful scalp may be a side effect of the dandruff the virus may cause or aches and pains associated with the illness. According to Kaiser Permanente, scalp pain and ailments may occur after recovering from a higher fever when dealing with a thyroid issue or if you have poor nutrition. According to an article published in St. Pete's Health Partners, a tingling, burning, or fizzing sensation was reported from several COVID-19 patients. This sensation may be a side effect of other symptoms such as aches and pains or fever. 74, 73, mid-back pain, base of ribs, and abnormally low blood temperature. According to the National Institute of Neurological Disorders and Stroke, back pain intensity can range from dull, constant ache to a sudden, sharp, and shooting pain. Those recovering from illnesses may report the pain due to decrease in movement over the past few days or due to unusual aches and pains of their sickness. 84 survey participants claimed mid-back pain and pain at the base of the ribs after having COVID-19. It's usually treated with muscle relaxants, gentle stretching, or heat or ice pads. After potentially experiencing a fever while fighting off COVID-19, sufferers may be surprised by the strange long-lasting symptom of a low body temperature. Once they've recovered, according to Kaiser Permanente, a low body temperature may occur with an infection or maybe a sign of diabetes or low thyroid levels. A low temperature may also be the culprit of chills, since the body attempts to warm up with narrowing blood vessels. Well, hell, that's me. I always got the chills. Bulging veins and hand and wrist pain. Your veins circulate the blood around your body, and when you're too cold or hot, your blood vessels may constrict or widen. This may be due to having a fever, then low blood temperature, or it may be a sign of dehydration. According to the Mayo Clinic, these bulging veins may be due to inactivity or damaged blood valves. I know I'm going to say this wrong. Arthralgia, joint pain, is a common symptom of coronavirus, and a study published in the Natural Public Health Emergency Collection found that at least one patient in the 40 that were studied experienced joint pain. This ailment may linger in those who had the virus, causing hand or wrist pain to remain. And that will conclude the 14 list for tonight. And we will continue on with this COVID-19 information tomorrow night. In the meantime, I will be posting on my Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram pages as to when we'll have Mr. Martin back on the air with us to enlighten us with some of his knowledge on writing, being an entrepreneur, and CEO of a really large publishing company, Who's Who. I'll get back to you with that information, so stay tuned to Aunt Lee's Treasures. And again, I'm sorry for the interruption, but We made it through. We always make it through. Mama gonna make it right one way or another. Hold on while I finish this really good tune, get my stuff together, and say goodnight to y'all. Give me a minute. Gentlemen, boys, and girls, thank you for being patient with me. Let's start the evening off right. It gives me great pleasure to introduce to our tonight's segment on our Black History series, Birthing Black-Owned Business. Tonight, we're spotlighting Mr. C. Sonny Martin. Mr. Martin has always defined his primary life mission as making a positive difference to enhance, uplift, and economically empower communities towards entrepreneurship. Mr. Martin has self-published 64 books in a span of 30 years. Ladies and gentlemen, let me tell you, as a writer, that's a whole lot of books. He is the founder and former CEO of Who's Who's Publishing Company. Mr. Martin has also produced award-winning television specials on diversity and inclusion. It gives me great pleasure as a new entrepreneur myself to introduce today's spotlight, Mr. Sonny Martin.
Good evening to you.
Good evening.
How you
good
doing?
Good evening. I am doing good. For a moment there, I said, oh, well, let me just regroup. I know, you know, things will turn out all right, and here you are. Thank you for joining.
Yeah, my bad. I've been finishing up with some clients all day long, and, of course,
mm-hmm.
the last one went longer than expected, but it's good to hear your voice. It's good to be on your show. And
thank you.
I salute you for all the positive vibes you're putting out there in the universe.
I'm trying to leave my footprints in the sand with our ancestors. Doing
there
it any
go.
Way
I, mean,
I can.
There you go. And everybody's got to start somewhere.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I've been looking at a few of your accolades here, and my very first question, Mr. Martin, that I just have to ask, can you express in words how it feels to receive accolades from our President of the United States, Mr. Barack Obama? I know he's
that
not
was,
our current president.
Yeah,
but.
Yeah, that was pretty interesting how that came about. You know, having started my publishing company in Atlanta, Georgia, I was in Chicago and I was doing a book for the Chicago market. And at the time, he was a senator. He wasn't president yet, but he announced he was running. So
mm-hmm.
I was trying to get him to show up at a major, huge event I did in Chicago, and he had a scheduling conflict. But he did produce a video for me to play at the event. And then, lo and behold, I was in Atlanta doing a book for the Atlanta market where I started business at.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just, like, completely blindsided by the fact that most of the legendary civil rights leaders in Atlanta, I had saw on the program that I was going to have Obama, and they just freaked out. And they said, no, cancel it, blah, blah, blah. We're not
cancel
behind
it.
Him. Well, you have to understand, this is at the beginning of Obama's presidency.
Oh, yes, yes.
And
right.
They were not on board. They were, you know, Brother Bill and Bill's wife was like family. You know, everybody said he was the first black president. And all the leaders to be very influential and distinguished folks in Atlanta said that they were behind Bill and Hillary Clinton and Hillary Clinton's running for president and not Obama because they had no knowledge of him, you know, in Atlanta.
Mm-hmm.
He's from Chicago. He
mm-hmm.
was a first-time senator. Hadn't even been senator that long at all. And they felt, you know, the old elder felt the audacity of him to think that he's going to run for president. You know, he hadn't really, you know, done anything yet, you know, on the national level other than out of Chicago. So Obama's folks didn't want to make a big scene because, you know, you had, you know, Ambassador Andrew Young, you had legendary civil rights legend John Lewis, you had the African-American female mayor, Shirley Franklin.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, listen, I don't want to really cause any hassles, you know, this, that, and the other. He said, just use that. He didn't say it to me, so I'm going to be perfectly clear. He did not.
You're ad-libbing.
but his communication people said, we don't want to cause any, you know, and disrupt. And I usually have like 1,200 people that come for one of my book receptions when I drop a book. And they didn't want to cause any hassle. They said, well, if you feel inspired, just run the video that we gave you to run in Chicago. So I said, I ain't care. I ain't never care. And I told Andrew Young, and, you know, he's an icon, you know, the very first African-American. I mean, he had been a mayor. I mean, he had been a congressman. He had been a mayor, then ambassador, the very first African-American ambassador to the United States. And I told him, I said, you know, with all due respect, Ambassador Young, I said, Martin Luther King was in his grave at the age of my mother. Yes.
At the age of?
Martin Luther King died in his 30s.
Okay.
That was the same age Obama was.
Oh, yes, yes. Okay.
So they were saying
that
he was too, yeah,
he
they
was
were
too
saying
young.
That Obama was too young.
Yes.
And I'm going, you know, you and John Lewis and Jesse Jackson, Reverend Abernathy, and a slew of other folks, y'all were just barely out of college when the civil rights movement really got started. And he said, well, he's still too young and inexperienced on a national stage. And we just know that that Bill Clinton is why they got our back and the policy we want to see implemented.
Well, he ended up showing the world, didn't he?
Well, I kind of bugged him, and I did play the video. I got, you know, I got a lot of and then, of course, Hillary's people didn't give me no video to play, and she didn't come to the event. So
I was very fortunate
that he gave me a lot of accolades.
Well, I definitely noted that. I definitely noted that and was impressed by it. And some of the other accolades that were mentioned. It's really, really impressive. I have a lot of questions about writing because you've published 64 books. So for, like myself, new writers that are starting out, what is the difference between an ISBN 10 and an ISBN 13 number on the book you go to publish, like on Amazon?
Yeah, well, Boker is the United States go-to organization for ISBN numbers. And for those listeners that don't know what ISBN number, it's kind of like your Social Security number, which identifies you and the title of your book as the author. And it's printed on the back and the inside cover of almost every book that you could ever realize.
And that means you have the rights to that book?
No, not necessarily. Not necessarily. You're just registering your book in print.
Okay.
Obviously, you've got to be able to get the federal copyright, which really protects you. I mean, you can claim a copyright. Anybody can, and put, you know, the circle C underneath the word. But unless it's registered, that protects you way stronger than someone tries to infringe upon your work.
Mm.
And it's absolutely most important that within a month or two, either before or at least 30 to 60 days after you publish a book, that you file for a national copyright and you register your book. That's very important.
And you do that through each state's own?
No, you go right to the federal United States Copyright and Patent Office and do it. You can do it online. Last time I checked, it was like $20.
Okay. That's not bad at all.
$20. I went even further than that. I got U.S. trademarks on my products. And see, when people see a circle and a TM, that's just an individual claiming they have trademark. That does not 99.9% of times means it's actually registered trademark. A registration of a trademark, attorneys will charge you a pretty penny for that. I never forget my first trademark. I spent $1,800 with an attorney to get, because you have to be able to put public notice. So if anyone feels that there's that whatever your name is or your book is or your title is an infringement on something that they're doing, they can protest the trademark. So it's got to be, once you submit the information to register it, within like 6 months or so, they wait and see if anybody's contested it. And then you go through with getting the trademark. And when you see a circle and an R, that is an indication that a name, a slogan, a product, it's got a federally protected trademark.
Wow.
Not the circle and the TM.
Right.
The circle and the R.
Right. That's totally covered.
So
full coverage or minimal coverage?
Well, it just covers, I mean, you have the right to be able to sue people for infringement on your trademark. I mean, obviously, it's a situation that, fortunately, I've never had anybody contest anything I've done, but it's a situation where, you got to have the funds to prove that you're right and wrong. And I want to tell you something. I've been involved in numerous legal lawsuits, and it's really all about who's got enough money to prove who's right or wrong, or the settlement.
Or who runs out of money first.
just like photography. You know, I absolutely one time in my life, in 64 books, I actually had somebody send me a certified letter. They wanted to file suit because a picture in my book, they were the photographer and they took the picture and owned the rights to that picture. And for me, I didn't infringe upon it. Somebody sent me the picture of themselves to put in my book. And I said, when you're somebody sending me something digitally, I don't see the back of the picture where it says, you know, copyrighted by photographer A, B, C, D, E. I just get the image in my inbox. So I have no knowledge. It's your copyrighted work. I don't know who took the picture, right?
So you won that.
And no, not necessarily. Uh-oh. It doesn't matter. You know, he had the rights because he was a photographer and he took the picture. So he had copyright on the picture and had registered the copyright on the picture. Because this person was a pretty famous person.
Oh,
so if someone
okay.
takes a picture of you, you do not own the rights to that picture. It's the photographer that took the picture that owns, that can claim he owns the right by getting it copyrighted. That's his work, right? So he sent me a very terse letter, and then he copied the National Photographer Such and Such Justice Association or whatever. So I had to settle with him. And I said, what do you want for the picture? You know, it's one of 500 pictures in my book, you know.
Right.
So it was just an aspect of negotiating.
Yeah,
I think I ended up paying $300 for it.
All that for nothing. I mean, that was just harassing.
For one picture.
Yeah.
but
still,
you
know.
Yeah. And that's what I tell people. You know, I've been in the publishing business since 1989. And I started out never, ever thinking in any dreams or aspirations to own a publishing company. I wrote a book, and I sent the manuscript out to various different publishing companies, hoped that they would give me a book deal. And it took me 17 months to write the book. And it was all based on 300 face-to-face interviews I had with people. And by the time I finished writing the manuscript and sending it out, within 6 months of me being finished with writing it, I ended up 47 turndown letters from small, medium, and large publishing companies that had zero interest in publishing it. And their reason was that this is 89 now, 1989.
Okay.
Black people don't read. Black people don't read.
Do. Yes,
they don't
do.
Go to the bookstore. They don't buy books. And literally, someone actually put in a letter to me that the best place to hide something from black people is in a book because they don't read.
I heard that before, too.
Yeah, so, you know, I'm in, here it is. I quit a six-figure corporate job to go out and write this book and thinking that it'd be, you know, a great success like we all think we were writing, a bestseller or whatever. Put in 17 months with zero income coming in, depleting my savings, and only to find out that nobody wants to publish this book. So I was just very blessed, very, very spiritually blessed to have the research, the head researcher at the Atlanta Public Library on the third floor. She had helped me do research.
Where all the books are.
Well, yeah, well, she, in the reference section, she had helped me do some research throughout the course of me doing that book. And she just literally got mad at me because I was depressed. And I said, listen, I might as well go jump off the Golden Gate Bridge. Ain't nobody in the world want to publish this book. I just got my 47th turndown letter. And she really got hostile with me. She said, listen, the Lord would have not sent you on this journey for you to give up at the 5-yard line.
Amen.
She said, I don't care what any publishing company has said to you. You're going to get this book in print. And the way that you're going to get it in print is I'm going to bring you some books on how to self-publish your own book, which I didn't even know was a thing. But I responded back to that lady. I said, listen, I've got maybe 50 cents in my pocket, and I don't know what a publisher does, but I know it takes money, and I got none of that.
Yeah, a lot of people.
And, yeah, and she told me, she said, well, you're going to sit here and either read these books on how to self-publish your book, and the light's going to come on in your head, or you will get out of my library. And she was just tough love. I mean, big time.
And it challenged you, and you did it.
Yeah,
it
was, I mean, she certainly did. She was like a great aunt. She was an old.
That's
lady,
that auntie right. For you. That's right. That's right.
Yeah, there you go. There you go. There you go. And she brought some 3 or 4 books over, and I spent maybe 2 days, 3 days going through those books, and it just boom. I mean, mind blown. Mind blown. Mind blown. A publisher.
And your focus for those young entrepreneurs. I know a few that start out with all this energy, gung ho, and they, you know, the thoughts and the vision is going, and then they lose steam. They lose steam. They lose focus. They lose, you know, researching, you know, what they're putting out, and they just lose the steam.
A lot of people. You know, they stopped too soon. You know, I could have walked away from it and gone back to my job. But once I read those books, you know, knowledge is very powerful. I said a publisher only does 4 things. That's all a publisher does is 4 simple things. He or she creates or acquires a work that's worthy to be published, number one. Number two is got to get it edited and printed. Number three, it's got to be able to market and sell it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's 4 little things. I'm going, okay. Number one, I got done. I've already
right.
created it.
Right.
Number two, I've not had it edited. I've not had it printed. But number three, if I had it printed and edited, I know I could sell it and market it.
Right.
That's 3 and 4. I'm going, so I wasn't that great in math, but looking at the lowest denomination, I only had one thing left to do was get it printed and edited.
Right.
So I immediately started getting on the phone and calling printing companies and telling them what I had and telling them what size I wanted it to be and how many pages it was and blah, blah, blah. And I wanted to get 5,000 copies, and they gave me a quote for 5,000 copies. And then I start asking around for, you know, people that do editing, teachers that are English teachers or whatever, whatever. Somebody said they'd edit, you know, the whole book for me for like $200 or whatever.
And
it was a lady with a master's degree in English. I said, okay. But I didn't have the $200, and I didn't have the $8,000 to get 5,000 books printed. because digital printing was not a thing back in those days. You had to actually get it offset.
Right, right, with ink.
And I said, so that's $8,400 I have to come up with, and I got 50 cents in my pocket. And so I said, well, let me go back and get my job back, my six-figure job back, see if they'll hire me back or have another position for me. And then I'll save up my money from my job. And then I'll put away money. Yeah, I had a plan. So I went to the appointment. First thing that asked a black man, well, what have you been doing for 2 years? You ain't been in jail or have been in no problem with drugs or nothing like that. That would be no. And everywhere I went, I carried my manuscript with me. So I brought out my manuscript and put it down. I said, I've been spending the last almost 23 months of my life writing a book and then trying to get somebody to print the book. And they were just blown freaking away when they started looking at the manuscript. They said, you did this? I said, yeah, I did this. And the book was an interview with 300 of the most successful, influential, and affluent African-Americans living in Atlanta. So in alphabetical order, I had everybody. Mm-hmm. And so the first name in the book, last name was Aaron, A-A-R-O-N. That was the first name in the book. And that's Hank Aaron, home run hitter Hank Aaron.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, you interviewed Hank Aaron? I said, I spent 3 days with Mr. Aaron at his house interviewing him. The world famous Hank Aaron that beat Babe Ruth's record.
I don't know why it's such a shock, you know. But like you said, this is back in the 80s.
Well, I mean, Hank Aaron is a really big
fan.
You know,
why are you shocked that, you know, this is what I do, I write, you know, so why wouldn't I interview Hank Aaron? But I get it, because Hank Aaron was big, and like Michael Jordan in a younger time.
Yeah. Well, the interview. Head of the HR company and the corporation, he was just a big baseball fan and just blown away that I spent that much time. So anyway, make a long story short, the greatness and goodness came from them wanting to support and get the book printed, and they wanted to sponsor it. And it was Toyota. It was Toyota.
Wow. See that?
And
see
said,
how that works?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's what I tell people. They said, listen, when people open up that book, we want them to see, you know, sponsored by Toyota there, the Atlanta Metropolitan Toyota dealerships. And if you can, when the book comes out, we can hold a reception, and you can possibly get Hank Aaron to be here and some of the other people, Pete, that you've interviewed to be here, it would be just great, because we're trying to brand Toyota as the import dealership towards African American community, for them not to buy Hondas or Infiniti or Nissan or Hyundai or whatever, and it's part of their marketing strategy, because Atlanta's quote unquote, you know, Wakanda, black city.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, what, you want to sponsor this is a book, you don't have no ads in it. I mean, I didn't know what the hell he was talking about, ads.
Mm-hmm.
I said, he says, we just. And then, of course, you know, I don't know if it was St. Peter or St. Paul slapped me inside the back of the head. He said, excuse me, they said they want to pay for it to get it print. You know, no, that's $8,400.
And,
you know,
there it was.
That's how.
And so you that was a great beginning. I mean, that was nothing but God's will, that whole thing. Because you almost gave up, you kept the fight, and then you ended up making the right connection that just led it into a great manifestation. That,
and you know, I believe we all have angels over our shoulders. If we put in the work, we're tested. We're tested over and over and over again. You know, I didn't tell you some of the stories that happened in the 17 months trying to do it. I became homeless. I got evicted.
Right.
My daughter and her mother had to move out, go back home to their parents. And I had family members that thought that they needed to do an intercession on me because I'd lost my mind, but quitting that good job and so forth and so on. So it was a mental battle. But, you know, here we are fast forward, you know, 11 years ago, and, you know, I ended up selling the company in a multi-million-dollar sale, and I created, you know, a brand of books that we became the largest African-American directory publisher in the country, you know, and did books coast to coast in 27 different metropolitan areas. And four times I was invited guests to the White House by four different presidents.
I read that. I did read that.
Yeah.
I read that.
So
I've also read that.
The takeaway that I want to get. Go ahead.
Yeah,
I'm sorry.
Nope. Because I was going to ask you about which book was it? It was, I think it was Black Mayors in America.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
2005 edition. I think it was.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was 2005 edition. That book, it was noted, Black Mayors in America is a useful and important resource for students of all ages, researchers, and libraries across the United States. Basically, the publication features rich editorial content that includes trailblazers such as former mayors, Carl Strokes of Cleveland, Maynard Jackson of Atlanta, Coleman Young of Detroit, Harold Washington of Chicago, David Dinkins of New York,
Bradley of LA.
Ohio's first African American mayor, Honorable Michael B. Coleman, and many, many more. So my question was, it is a good resource to have in schools. Have you had any luck getting it into?
Oh, that book sold out in a very short period of time. I mean, that book was like sold out literally before, while it was coming off the presses.
I bet.
Number one, you have to go behind the drapes and see what made that book happen. It wasn't my original idea. It wasn't my vision. I had the National Black Mayors Association reach out to me.
Okay.
And it is a legitimate national organization of black mayors, small and large, from all over the country, that's been in existence for 30, 40 years. And they had seen the book that I did on black judges in America for the National Bar Association, which is the largest association of black attorneys. So when he did a book for the black judges, he can do a book for the black mayor. So that's how it needs to be.
I've seen black judges too first. Yep.
Yeah. Their organization has enough sustainable members in it that they bought up all the copies of the book, and I was paid a retainer to be able to do that project. And it was the first time in the history of the United States somebody had ever done a book on America's black mayors and how they came to fruition, because when white folks moved out of the central cities to the suburbs, the central cities became black, and when the central cities became black, they elected black mayors. New York, Chicago, Philadelphia, Atlanta, Georgia, Los Angeles, Detroit, all these huge black, Cleveland, Ohio, the very first African-American mayor of a major city was in Cleveland, Ohio, Carl B. Stokes. So it was a phenomenon that happened that, you know, was like a wildfire that spread throughout the whole country, that black men started running for mayor, black people started running for mayor.
Right, but we can't print that book again?
I can't bring that book back to life. Oh, I sold my publishing company, so I do not have the rights to that book anymore.
Oh, no.
I sold all my federal trademarks and everything.
I'd like to read that book.
Yeah. But it was just a great opportunity to do a book. And, you know, I committed to 5,000 copies of that book. And like I said, by the time the book was coming off the press, they were all sold out.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
The organization had put out.
Because that's the first thing I thought about is like, can we get this book in the schools? Let's put this in mind of the young kids. You know?
Unfortunately, the people that bought my company, they had never been in the publishing business before. They had acquired four or five local black newspapers, were trying to take those newspapers digital so that they could look like they're a national company, they bought me, raised enough money to buy me so they can say that they're a national company, because I had my footprint was in 27 major cities throughout the United States, from L.A. to New York, Houston, Dallas, San Antonio, Chicago, Detroit, everywhere.
As a writer?
It was a jump. They used me as what we call in the business a jump off, but none of their people had ever been in the publishing business whatsoever. They were acquiring.
Well, how do we find jump offs in the 21st century? The new entrepreneurs coming up, how do they find jump offs nowadays? As
well,
the writers that are coming out,
every year,
I know a lot of them.
50,000 new books that come on the marketplace by first time publishers. Here is our first time authors. Here's what I tell people. When I got into business 89, I had never met or known anybody that had ever put out a book, especially self-published their own book. I had never met anybody. Today, there's as many people doing books as you got hairs on your heads that look like us. However, what the problem is, they have not. To write the book is one thing. That's a lot of energy. That's a lot of work. It's a lot of time. Where people fail miserably, is knowing how to market and sell the book.
Mm-hmm.
The average individual that puts out their own self-published authored book might sell 100 copies or less. Friends, family, coworkers, neighbors, and that's it. And then they stop right there. Whereas, if I took the mindset of a publisher, what's a publisher's number one job?
Get the book out there, known, heard, seen.
The number one job is to sell the book and make money, you know? And you got to have that kind of entrepreneurial mindset that you're not, I mean, you know, there's a lot of people that do write books for all kinds of different reasons and vanity and leave a legacy and all that. But what good is a book if no one opens it up and reads it? You got to get, you know, as much time and effort you put into writing a book, you got to spend twice that much time and efforts in promoting the book before it's even done.
Exactly.
You know, you can do pre-sales. You send press releases out to the media. You got to put together a database of at least 500 people, local, regional, and national people, that you're going to send a press release about your book. And you're going to articulate in that press release why they need to read the book. Why does anybody need to read this book? What are they going to get from reading this book? What is the story? You've got to be able to tease them to the point that they're anxious, that they want to hit that link and buy the book, or hit a link to find out more about you, the author. And if you don't do none of that, man, I just talked to a client 2 days ago. Never put a book out. Didn't literally talk to anybody. Spent a stupid amount of money with a self-publishing company to get her book done. The cover, she never talked to anybody. The cover was very unattractive. It was, the graphics were done very amateurish. And it was just a book about her life. She's kind of a free spirit, you know, in the metaphysical and meditation and all this sort of stuff. And she's got 5,000 books sitting in her house, and she sold 100 of them. And she just puts a picture of the book on Facebook. And I said, how much money have you invested in advertising and marketing your book? Nothing. I'm just posting it up on my Instagram and this, that, and the other. I said, tell me you're not serious.
Should be out at the local store asking, can you put it up, and all that other kind of stuff. I agree. You have to put in the effort. I mean, if you have the passion to start it, and you have the vision to see it, then you gotta. My thing is I keep getting writer's block, and big chunks of time go by, and I don't write. But then when I do start to write, I keep going, and then I get writer's block again.
That story can be duplicated a million times, a million times. I've not run into an author that had said the same thing.
Wow. Well, I'm working it out now. It's going to get worked out.
No, but it's natural.
Yes.
Unless you have deadlines that you have to, you know, like writers and newspapers and magazines have deadlines, you know, it happens. You lose your thought, the creativity. You say, oh, no, I want to change this. I want to do this.
Right.
Oh, man, I need to add this.
Yeah.
It happens. But there's a word called discipline. Now, I don't care what it is you're trying to do in life. You got to set a date and a goal for it to be finished.
Mm-hmm.
And you got to be disciplined enough to meet that deadline in your own spirit of your work. Because we all exchange hours for dollars. And when the hours are gone, we can't get them back. So you have to be, I have to tell this, you know, here it is, I'm 30 years being, I tell myself that every day. All right, Sonny, get off social media. You got this to do, you got that to do, you got this to do. And you put dates when you're supposed to have this done.
Mm-hmm.
And you're behind.
I've got all those. My whole wall is sticky notes and friggin' storyboards and schedules.
Same.
Wow. Mr. Martin, I really appreciate you coming to Ali's Treasures, our little treasure box here, and sharing your little nuggets with us and giving us those that are starting out on whatever business, whatever journey. You know, the little nuggets that you've had over the years as a publisher, as a business owner, as a black man in business, and some of the challenges you face and your accomplishments of getting through them. They were nuggets. I gotta tell you, I've got notes over here.
Okay.
Got a lot of notes. And we'd love to have you back anytime to give any little shout outs on anything new that you're doing. If you can just let us know what your entrepreneurial training, your urban entrepreneur training is all about, and how someone can contact you with further information, that would be good.
Well, yeah, after selling my company, you know, I just said to myself, with the knowledge I've gained throughout the years building a multi-million-dollar company, less than 2% of African Americans will ever have a $1 million company. And I felt gifted. I felt blessed to pass my knowledge and information and skill set to a newer generation. My daughter's a school teacher. She has zero interest in being a business owner because she loves kids. So I wrote an urban entrepreneur handbook that's like 100 pages, something I would give my younger self starting out in business throughout the three businesses I've owned in life. And I've been mentoring a lot of young startups and entrepreneurs, getting them to monetize their business model. Everybody's got creative ideas, but those creative ideas got to be monetized to make you money.
Right.
And helping a lot of people do that. And then, you know, the most exciting thing I've been working on the last 2 years is a youth entrepreneur franchise. And we actually sold our first franchise, then COVID.
Okay.
So we've not opened up the doors yet. So we're having to pivot also in creating the curriculum that me and three or four educators designed. We actually put together a youth entrepreneur curriculum because entrepreneurship is not taught in middle schools or high schools.
Right.
So we're taking the curriculum now into an online course. That's what we're doing right now.
Yes.
So I'm really excited about that.
How can our listeners get to know more information about that, contact you, or leave questions?
Yeah.
If they have.
On every social media platform at C. Sonny Martin, LinkedIn, Facebook, Instagram. I have the Urban Entrepreneur Facebook page. We've got 88,000 people all over the world that follow that page. I post on it every single day. The address is @ The Urban Event Center, but the page is called the Urban Entrepreneur. That's kind of what I call myself, the Urban Entrepreneur.
Okay, so it's the Urban. T-H-E.
Well, no, the Urban Event Center is the actual address to the page on Facebook.
Okay.
But when you get to that, when you type that in, you'll see Urban Entrepreneur. You'll see my logo up there. But I post on that every single day. I got people in 28 foreign countries and all 50 states that follow that page, where I drop nuggets and, you know, it's just free information.
Well, I'm getting ready to go and check it out.
Yeah,
so
then I
will
have
be...
a Urban Entrepreneur private group page where I get a little bit more in detail. We exchange, you know, people respond and
like
post their businesses
things.
Up.
Okay.
Yeah. But it's been a pleasure spending this evening with you, and good luck to you. Feel free to reach out to me anytime. My email is my name, Sunny, S-U-N-N-Y. My mother was hoping that I'd be bright, so she named me Sunny with a U. It's Sunny at csunnymartin.com. But the letter C is my first initial that I've not used my first name since probably 45 years ago.
But, I was going to ask, but I said, let me leave it alone.
You would never guess. I win $100 to people all the time. Give them 10 tries to guess what my first name is that begins with a C, and they never guess it. And it's crazy. But anyway, when I got it, the story is,
you just told me what it
when
was.
When I left television and got into radio, they wouldn't let me use my very first name. And I said, well, how am my mama going to know who I is if I don't use my first name? They said, what's your middle name? I said, Sonny with a U, but it sounded like a girl's name. They said, oh, no, we love Sonny, 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 Sonny. So that was
well, okay.
40-some years ago. And there is not nobody except a family member that knows me by my first name. Everybody in the world. If you just
okay,
look,
I'm
going to
take
Google
a guess
book,
at it. I'm going to take a guess at it.
Sonny. I give you 10 guesses, then you probably wouldn't guess.
I'm going to say it's Crazy Sonny Martin.
Yeah, that's it. I didn't say that. Every day I wake up, you know how you can tell true entrepreneur? When they wake up in the morning, they either think they're insane or they're a genius.
Well, I'm going to leave on that note. Thank you for joining us here in the Treasure Box. This is your host, Aunt Lee, signing off with Mr. Sonny Martin. Good night, everybody. Thank you.